Hi, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballingee. Good to have you here with us. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Follow me on Twitter, @RyanBallingee. You can follow Golf News Net on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com and twitter.com/golfnewsnet. Find all of our work at thegolfnewsnet.com as well on Yahoo Sports, on the Devil Ball Golf blog at sports.yahoo.com. If you're a listener to this show, a subscriber through iTunes or another podcasting service, thanks for doing it. Thanks for being so loyal to the program. Please check out Golf News Net Radio, which is a 24/7 stream of golf talk available on our website, golfnewsnet.com, our on-demand site, golfnewsradio.com, as well on the iTunes service and the TuneIn Radio app. So this week on the show, we've got a little bit of a transition from Harding Park and the WGC Match Play to the Players Championship, and there's really a nice stretch coming up here, which really does start with the Masters in a couple weeks, blah. And then you have some nice weeks here with the Match Play in a one-year situation playing in May. And then you've got, obviously, the Players this week. You've got a very nice tournament next week in Charlotte at Quail Hollow, a tournament that is on a major championship site, at least that will be one in 2 years' time. So really nice run here, and then we get into the Memorial Tournament, and all of a sudden it's close to time for the U.S. Open. So golf is picking up, great time of year, and we're really excited about it. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Match Play, what we liked and what we didn't like about the new format, just as well going into the Players' Championship, what to expect. And I want to save a very little bit of time at the end for a situation regarding a colleague, Stephanie Way, and her having the credentials that she had as a national member of the media revoked by the PGA Tour for the remainder of the season. Just want to touch on that very briefly at the end of the show. So first, let's talk about what we liked about the new Match Play format. And I have to admit, the round-robin thing, the group play thing, it worked for the most part. You have 112 matches altogether. That's more matches than you were going to get in the 64-man one-and-done format, because you're going to get 65 that way with the consolation match. So that all worked out pretty well. You get more golf, good stuff. Every player gets 3 matches, which is also good. At least 2 of them matter, which is good. And then I think that once you got into the breakout style, the knockout style, I think that works really well also. You know, I kind of struggled here, especially on Friday, trying to watch this because I didn't know what matches really mattered and what didn't. And I read the scenarios that the PGA Tour put out about what matches did matter, what had implications, and all of those things. I get it, and I don't. I think because it's not a style we think about here too often in the U.S. among sports fans, it's just not something that clicks right away. The same thing's true in the World Cup for soccer, where you have group play, and then all of a sudden you go into the knockout round, and there's really no understanding for most casual fans of why you're going from knockout pool one or round robin pool A to knockout position 6. All of those things don't make sense to people. At least this was sensible in that there was 116, 215, 314, and so forth, and then eventually became that tournament style format that we know really, really well. My issue here with this entire format was really matches that didn't matter. And as it turned out, one of the matches that didn't matter was the most entertaining of the week, at least in terms of foibles, and that is Miguel Angel Jimenez and Keegan Bradley, who were kind of on edge from really about the 13th hole and giving a putt. And then all of a sudden, you know, it turned that thing on 18 where Keegan Bradley will look like an absolute asshole. And I understand why he's upset, and I understand why he wanted to defend his caddy, Steve Hale. And I know Steve a little bit. I've spent some time with him. But I get the sensation, watching it over and over again, that Jimenez wasn't trying to instigate anything. That's not who he is. I mean, you know who he is. He's cigars, wine, and sex. He is not fighting. That's not who he is. So he wasn't trying to do anything there. He was trying to figure out whether or not he was getting a good deal from the drop series of drops, really, that Bradley and Hale were having to take to get away from a broadcast facility on the 18th hole of their match. Money is on the line here. Placement is on the line there. So it does mean something to him, Meneth. It does mean something in the end, financially speaking, regardless of whether or not the matches matter to who advanced in the tournament. So in that, you know, I guess if I'm Bradley, and I week to week, very rarely, obviously, play official match play. Play match play on Tuesdays with Phil and the boys for money. But there's not a rules official out there to make decisions. They just all kind of decide on things when it comes up. In this case, when you're playing tournament golf, almost 99 times out of 100, you call the rules official over to make the decision because you know that if they make a mistake, you're still covered. It's an insurance policy. You know that if they make a boo-boo, it doesn't affect your scorecard. Same thing happened to Lydia Ko with the North Texas shootout for the LPGA, where she probably could have missed the cut since she made on the number had the proper penalty been called when her ball got stuck in a tree. It should have been a lost ball because she didn't observe it, or caddy couldn't find it, and it wasn't easy to identify. If you could have done that, then that would have been fine. But she got to declare an unplayable, which is unbelievable. But when you call on the official, you expect a good ruling and you expect immunity. And that's not the way it works in match play. Match play is more about an agreement between the two players as to what the rule is than between the two players and the official. So it was perfectly within Jimenez's right to get over there and wonder what was going on and what it meant for him at his position, one up in the match with the last hole to play. It doesn't make golf look bad that those guys got into an argument. It makes Keegan Bradley and Steve Hale look bad that they got into that argument because they didn't handle it with much machismo. And I think it almost seemed more like a playground scuffle than a strongly worded disagreement between two very capable professionals, one of them being a major champion. And we shouldn't hold major champions to a different standard. They won a golf tournament. They're not elite just because they, as human beings, because they won a golf tournament. But in the end, I think that's the appeal of match play. It may not get that far all the time, but it's emotional. You playing one person for 18 holes, you build up something in yourself about them. One way or the other. Either that they are better than you, that you're better than them, that you hate them. You really like them. You don't want to beat them that much. But there's some emotion that goes on in your head and in your heart, I guess, you know, whatever cliche you want to use. But the emotion you feel is real. And I don't think that always happens to the same extent in a golf tournament because you're playing the course. You're typically not in a match play situation in stroke play. It does happen if you got a chance to win. But more often than not, that doesn't always work. The emotions are different. It's just nerves. It's pure nerves in stroke play. It's I've got a chance to win. Don't clam up. Don't choke. It's different in match play. It's I'm going to beat this SOB. I'm definitely not choking. Pull off the shot. And that's why I like it so much. Because it's emotional. Not because it's different. I mean, different is different. But there are 18 potential battles, if not more, since they play overtime in this championship. I love that. And I wish that's why we saw more match play. And I don't want to see 64-guy field all the time. But it wouldn't hurt to have a couple more match play events every year. Can you imagine, and this is an argument I've made for years and years, so this isn't specifically related to this, but let's go with it. Can you imagine that had they conceived the FedEx Cup as stroke play pretty much all the way through until the Tour Championship, and then it was mano a mano for the final tournament or for the final four or whatever, for $10 million. Can you imagine the tension, the emotion between Bradley and Jimenez, if that was the final for $10 million? Oh, wow. I mean, that would have been fisticuffs and then some. And I think that is the way it should be. It shouldn't be robotic. It shouldn't be rote. And I guess that's where I feel like the tour misses misses it. But they did this entire thing. They did this entire round robin setup for television and for fans. And you have to give them credit. It was for fans. So that they got to see more of their favorite players during the weekday rounds. Because in the past, Wednesday was the most fascinating day at this tournament because everyone was still in it, and there were going to be some very serious upsets. But then once all the upsets happen, you realize all of a sudden Danny Willett's still around, but Rory's not. Well, I'm not watching Danny Willett play, and I like Danny Willett. I'm not taking time out of work to go watch Danny Willett play golf. Not yet. So I think that the tour very smartly recognized that if you're going to keep eyeballs on this for very long, then you've got to keep them around for at least half the tournament. So they did. Good. Saturday and Sunday matches were great. They weren't necessarily everybody involved. I mean, it wasn't 1, 2, 3, and 4 in the world there. But Jim Furyk and Rory McIlroy was a great semifinal match. To play the final 3 holes and 4 under par for McIlroy to get the win, and I mean, that's a total pipping. I mean, that's an absolute Furyk thing to happen. And he didn't choke. It wasn't like a Furyk, your classic Furyk choke where it just doesn't work. And he kind of chokes it away. I'm thinking Olympic club here. He got beat. And that's the beauty of match play. You're never out of it. Even when the strokes, when it's not stroke play, I love that. And then the final match was not a great match, but it was a very good exhibition from McIlroy against Gary Woodland, where he basically recognized, probably on the first or second hole, that Woodland didn't have it, or he was nervous, or both. And he went 1, 3 holes, and I think he played them in 1 under. He didn't play them spectacularly well. And he realized he had the tournament in his hand. Got up 4, and then just kind of coasted until he lost 2 holes and then said, wait, this isn't going to happen. 1, 2 holes and put it away. That's how you do it. I mean, that is match play at its best. When you know you've got a weak opponent and you pounce, and then you just kind of ride it out, and you can exert as much or as little energy as you want to put the match away. I really like that. That's the way to do it. And I think it tells you a lot about Rory McIlroy as a competitor. Match play, in this case, really tells you a lot about how he approaches stroke play. Because you can look at all of Rory's major wins, and 3 of them are in very significant fashion. I mean, big margins, 2 record-type margins. In those tournaments, he didn't play 72 great holes. No one ever plays 72 great holes. But Rory doesn't even play like 65 good holes. He plays like 60 good holes. And 12 of the other holes are either pars, bogeys, or worse. And when he plays for pars and makes those pars, he can win. And win by a lot if he plays 60 really good ones. If he plays 60 really good holes, 2 extremely bad holes, 3 holes, and the others are okay, he's going to lose. So the balance for him is figuring out he knows he's not going to play them all great. So he needs to play great when he needs to play great and play mediocre when he knows he's going to have a lull. And he managed that brilliantly this week. Like I mentioned, he didn't have his A stuff. His A stuff, he played 64 really good holes, 8 kind of blah blah holes if this were a stroke play event, and he'd blow the field away, which he does. But he didn't do that. I like that. I like that. That shows his confidence in understanding, and we talk about this in other sports, time and score. You need to know time and score. And there is time and score and extent in golf. How many holes do you have left, and where are you in relationship to the guy you got to beat? Whether it's a match play or stroke play. McIlroy gets that, I think, just as well as anybody, as well as anybody as I've seen since Tiger Woods. He knows time and score. Jordan Spieth is a little bit different. He played the best golf of anybody through the first 3 days. If it were a 54-hole stroke play tournament, I think the statistic was he would have won by like 6 or 7. He plays every hole really well. And part of that is just being a 21-year-old kid who doesn't know the difference. And part of it is he is so intense, he over every shot matters, that He has to play that way. He can't just take holes off and throw it on and throw it off. That's not how he does it. So while he played better than everybody else, he didn't play the format better than everybody else. And this is part of his maturation process, where he will learn over time. Maybe he doesn't have to play all 270 shots of the week like it's life and death, but instead to play the important shots like they're life and death, and learn the difference between what's important and what isn't, because it's all relative. Every shot obviously counts the same in the end, but there's an additional bonus or penalty involved in certain shots in certain situations. That's what McIlroy gets, and that's what Spieth can learn from McIlroy, and that's why Spieth said today at his players' news conference that he's still got a little way to go to make it a rivalry and catch Rory McIlroy. That is the difference right there, is understanding time and score. It really is. Both of them are perfectly capable of dominating golf tournament, blowing fields away, setting records. They've both done it in the majors. But McIlroy gets time and score better. So as we transition to the players, I think in one sense, that will actually hurt McIlroy, even though he's had some very nice finishes the last 2 years in this tournament. Because I believe more shots matter in a tournament, in this tournament, the players, at this venue, than a lot of other golf courses. Because the way Pete Dye set up this course, to me, you have to play every shot as an important one. Almost everyone. And that's why it's just a mental grind. I mean, there are not a lot of shots on the course where you can just go, just put it out there and you'll be fine. Number one, you block that on the left. Number two, you really don't want to be right. Number three, fine, you hit the green, it doesn't matter. Four, you're just trying to get it out there, that's fine. Five, you got to hit a cut. Six, with that tree gone, you can do whatever. Seven, same thing. Just don't put it left in the water. Eight, it's just a tough, long par three. And nine, you can do whatever. So that's the front nine. And those are tee shots. But so often in this course, the stadium course, you're standing on the tee, you're standing looking at the green going, oh, there's no room. I don't know where I'm going to put this. So it is a psychological battle to beat Pete Dye. And I think I knew Jonathan Bird wasn't going to be meant for greatness when I asked him of the first players I ever covered, or maybe the second, about Pete Dye trying to get in your head on the tee. And he just didn't get the question. Like he was oblivious to what was happening to him. Or maybe he just didn't see it, or maybe didn't think anything of it. But he didn't understand what Pete Dye was trying to accomplish. And I honestly do not think it occurred to him what was probably happening in his brain as he stood in the tee box. Because it's more target golf. It's where I've got to hit it here, I've got to hit it there, and then I've got to hit it there. In that order, and if I do that, I will probably make birdie. Tiger Woods alluded to it a little bit yesterday when he said that sometimes when you play this course, if you play it right, you feel like you got to shoot 67. I mean, the par fives are gettable. They're not very difficult. 11 somewhat challenging, but you can still make an easy wedge birdie. If you're playing really good golf, you can fit the prescription. You can fill it. You can hit every shot that you need to hit and score extremely well. And the ball, given the design of these greens and where the PGA Tour puts the hole placements, it has a way of filtering to the hole. So if you hit the shot you're supposed to hit, you're going to get rewarded. It's not like a U.S. Open where you hit a great shot and it bounces off the green, off the back, and you're dead. It doesn't work like that. That's why I like the players. It's pretty fair in that regard. It's not easy by any stretch of the imagination. But if you hit the prescribed shot, you get a good result, and you can count on that reliability. And I think when McIlroy taking off more shots than most, really good players at least, that leaves him battling to figure out when shots matter. And maybe as he's played this a little bit more, he knows the holes that aren't so taxing mentally. And we just described them on the front nine. We can do it on the back nine, but I won't waste your time. But you kind of have a better sense as you play this course where you need to care and where you can kind of freestyle it. And maybe that's why McIlroy has good results the last couple of years. Spieth, this is his second players finished T4 last year because he took every shot seriously. He created for himself a spot where he needed to hit the ball, and he did it for the most part. And it worked out for him. I think that is probably closer to the approach I would want to take if I was going to win this, if I were to win it. But there you go. I also like that this is a golf course where you got to keep it in play. It's a very different thing than the Masters. And the Players is really, it is trying to be the Masters. It's trying to be that in that regard. It used to want to be the first one because it was in March. Now it's in May because the golf course plays better in May. It also is played on the same course every year. It also has traditions that it does every year. It also has a really great three-hole stretch that happens to end the course instead of in the middle of it. You know, all of those things. It wants to be the Masters. And in this regard, it is not. It's complete opposite. You can't play TPC Sawgrass from all over the lot. You will get destroyed out there. You could score okay at Augusta National if you've got a short game, but you can't get off the tee to save your life. What's the difference between those two as tournaments? I prefer sometimes one or the other, but I think both are really interesting in that regard, that they have a certain tolerance. Tolerance is way bigger for the Masters off the tee, keeping it in play, than at the Players. I think there's less of a tolerance from the fairway at Augusta National. And I think it's fairly close to the same on the greens, but there's a lot more penalty on the greens at Augusta National when you're way off than at the stadium course, where you can, I'm not going to say you can lag it every time for a two-putt, but I think I'd rather try to make a two-putt from 50 feet at a stadium course than at Augusta National, because it's just so dramatic. So, very fun contrast, and I think people have begun to appreciate it over time, see the differences between the two, know what the Players is, know what it is, and it's not a major. It may be in 20 years, but it is not a major now. Just a really, really great golf tournament we're going to enjoy this weekend. So, hopefully you enjoy it. Hopefully, if you lay a few bucks on it, you find a winner. In terms of people that I like, obviously you've got to like Spieth and McIlroy. I think you've got to like Lee Westwood and Jim Furyk. Henrik Stenson has a nice record. And pay a little attention to Tiger Woods. Just a little bit. I'm not saying to put some money on him. But pay some attention to the guy. And I'll say that because he speaks like a guy who's tired of being tired of playing like crap. And he didn't play like crap at Augusta. Played pretty well. He's got a short game that he seems pretty confident in at this point. And if he can get it into play, and he doesn't have to hit driver here, which is a huge asset for him, does not have to hit driver here. If he can keep it in play with a 3-wood or 2-iron or whatever he chooses this week, maybe it's a 5-wood, he's gonna have a chance. He's going to have a chance. And that would make for some fascinating golf. All right, let's get to the final portion of the show. It's a very brief comment about what happened to my colleague, Stephanie Way. She was out at the WGC Cadillac match play, and on Monday, I believe it was Monday, she decided to use Periscope, which is a streaming video service that Twitter owns, basically, even though it's a separate company, but they own them, and it allows people to share live streaming video over social media. And it creates an opportunity for interaction because people are watching the video, can comment and ask questions, and you get that feedback in real time on screen. It's not all that different than a Ustream or a live stream. It's just now connected more directly to social media, namely the social media channel most everybody turns to for legitimate news. If you're reading news on Facebook, you're doing it wrong. And Stephanie was showing a practice round involving several players, including Jordan Spieth. And she was getting great feedback about it, and people were very happy to see that kind of information and that kind of visual content, because you're not going to get that from the tour on a Monday. It's just, that's just not what they do. And she did her thing and then probably forgot about it for a little while. Well, a couple days later, the tour came up to her, a representative from the tour, Chris Reimer, who's a good dude. He works on their media staff. So I'm the bearer of bad news. We're going to have to revoke your credential. And Stephanie was obviously very surprised, although it sounds like from a podcast that she did with our mutual friend Shane Ryan, that she had some sense that this conversation may have been taking this turn when it started. And that leads me to believe she probably had a sense that this was a gray area, at a minimum, showing this video, even though it disappears after 24 hours, over social media. She clearly violated the PGA Tour's media regulations, and as the way the PGA Tour tells it, this wasn't the first time, but like the fifth or sixth time that she's done this. Over what period of time, I don't know. I don't know if it's 5 years, if it's 2 years. We don't know what the tally is there. But to them, this was the final nail in the coffin, in addition to a violation earlier in 2015 when Stephanie took some Instagram or Insta videos of Tiger Woods during the Waste Management Phoenix Open practice rounds. And there's been quite a bit of back and forth in the media among some of her detractors. Really haven't said anything. Some folks who have said, well, you should just follow the rules. Her allies, including Alan Shipnick of Sports Illustrated, said, the point here is that this is a dinosaur-esque relationship between the PGA Tour media and new technologies, including Periscope, its rival Meerkat, even though it's not much of a rival, and things like that. This is a tough situation. I view it two ways, and I have to view them completely separately. Stephanie violated the rules of the PGA Tour's media agreement that was apparently last updated in 2006, according to Stephanie. But those rules are absolutely crystal clear in terms of what media, credentialed media, can and cannot do with video, whether it disappears or whether it's permanent, whether you're TV or whether you're internet. You basically get 2 minutes. It can't be live. It can't purport to be live. And it can't be tournament action. How the tour interprets all of those words basically means that for them, if you're showing golfers playing golf or practicing golf and it's live and it's video and it's on site, on the grounds, then that violates their policy. It's the end. Now, is it a strange time to drop the hammer for the PGA Tour? Yeah. They could have done it any other time, but it probably would have been the same amount of backlash, more or less. So, Stephanie has violated the rules. She is now without a credential for the remainder of the season. She's going to go cover the European Tour, which, hey, kudos to you. That tour deserves some coverage. They got some great events coming up, and probably no one from the States is going there, so she's going to have a nice opportunity to be able to get some really cool coverage. So that's good stuff. But at the same time, I do believe that the tour is a little over the top in terms of guarding their intellectual property. And Ty Votel, who I've had plenty of arguments with in the past, and I like arguing with him because he's a lawyer type guy and I have fun with that kind of stuff, but I have a problem with him personally. He didn't come across all the best in the world. He really didn't. In the SI piece. But I understand his point. Golf Channel, NBC, CBS, they pay a lot of money to the PGA Tour every year so that they can broadcast the PGA Tour. And that includes what you're seeing if you're watching Golf Channel this week, those Live From specials. That's rights. Remember in the early years of Live From, you really saw almost nothing? That's because they didn't have the same rights as they do now. And the tour has evolved in that regard, not only in terms of broadcast, but digital, extending rights to their broadcast partners on the digital scale so that you can watch the Golf Channel Live Extra app, so that you can watch PGA Tour Golf for free, not that you couldn't anyway, but stream it on CBSSports.com and PGAtour.com when when the eye has it. They understand the concept of protecting the people that pay them. So when people like me or Stephanie or Golf.com or Golf Digest or anybody else that does not have digital video rights to the PGA Tour, when it comes to them, those organizations and those people, they're on the outside looking in of opportunities to work with video on the PGA Tour. In one sense, actually in several senses, that discourages coverage because it discourages innovation. However, if we paid for it, if we paid for the right to do it, and therefore monetize it back on our own end, then maybe it all could work out. But that's not where we're at, and that's not where we're going to be at for the next 10 years because of the length of the contract between the PGA Tour and its broadcast partners. So, at the end of the day, that relationship, those relationships, compel the likes of Stephanie, myself, and others who are not rights holders to come up with innovative ways to cover the tour, or to cover golf, or to cover something else, or to cover the LPGA, which is extremely friendly about these things, or the European Tour, who is equally friendly and would love for all of us to go over there to wherever they're playing this week, their opposite, or their main event, which is really an opposite field event. They would all love those things. And I'm not sensing that there's going to be a sudden sea change where the remaining golf media, as small as we are going to collectively decide to boycott the PGA Tour. That said, this is the last piece of the argument. As a guy who doesn't get to many PGA Tour events anymore, I have a 2-year-old son, I have a family, I run a business, I'm not just writing, I'm not just traveling. I don't cover a lot of tournaments. I've intended to go to the Players this week and wound up going to a bachelor party instead the prior weekend. Had a better time. And the next tournament I'm going to cover is for Yahoo Sports, the U.S. Open in June. I will cover the AT&T National here locally when it comes here to Northern Virginia in July. I'll cover the PGA Championship in August. I may cover a FedEx Cup playoff event. That would be 4 tournaments this year. That would be the most tournaments I've covered in 3 years, in a single season. Also, be the most majors I've ever covered in a year. No, I did 3 1 year. So, for me, and for anybody who goes to a media center, and there are increasingly fewer people that go into those media centers, there's less and less incentive to go. For one, there are less of us. For two, the budgets are smaller. You don't quite get that expense account when you're not turning the same profit on the web as you were with your magazine. 3, the access is different because the PGA Tour sides with itself and its broadcast partners. So those guys get slightly better stuff. Not drastically better, but slightly better stuff. And the accessibility is a little bit more difficult than it used to be. So then, what's the point of getting a credential? It is a privilege. It is a request. It is not a demand. But with that request comes all of these strings. The very same strings that got Stephanie Way to lose her credential. But I can run a very successful golf website not covering the tour as a credentialed media member. In fact, it creates liberties for me. Because if I'm not a credentialed member of the PGA Tour media, I can show you video off of TV. Whereas the tour could email me if I had posted a video to Instagram or wherever, more or less a screen capture or video capture of a goofy shot or Jim Furyk practicing putting in his sandals like he did this morning. They could email me and say, well, it's our property, you're a credentialed media member. You need to take that down. Or we won't credential you. The "or we won't credential you" part is the threat. Because under fair use guidelines, you can pretty much get away with a 5 to 10 second clip. You can get away with a 30 second clip. If it demonstrates something, demonstrates a clear thing. So, if there's more freedom to be gained, potentially, by not being a credentialed member of the media, at least in terms of what you publish, what's the incentive then to be a credentialed member of the media? I'm not weighing that seriously. I don't think to myself, I'm not going to cover tour events anymore because I can post screen capture videos. That's absolutely silly. But if I were an upstart publisher and I just wanted to do whatever I wanted to do without any recourse, you know, any punishment, I just wouldn't get credentialed. I wouldn't even bother through the process. And I think that that is a potential danger in all of this that the tour has to consider. Maybe not on a grand scale because your digests, your golf channels, your golf weeks, your golf.com/magazines, they're going to send somebody to the bigger tournaments at least. But for your week to week, get your local newspaper guys and some radio stations, and they don't know shit about golf, so what's it matter anyway? They can be there. So this is a potential to have a broader, more interesting discussion about, not whether or not Periscope is video or not. Let's move on from that. Whether you agree with the punishment that Stephanie got. She broke the rules, bottom line. So, moving forward, and Stephanie could be a spearhead for this conversation, as well as others, what is the relationship then between the PGA Tour and its non-rights-holding media partners, the credentialed media that work with them? And is there some clear benefit, some clear pro-con that works out in favor of pro? And if it doesn't, then it needs to be changed, what the media can and cannot do on site, to reflect a pro for everybody. And if it's just a pro for the PGA Tour, then that should be fundamentally changed. Or the media needs to decide collectively the juice is not worth the squeeze. I think this is a longer term game, and this may not all, the last 10 minutes of the show, not matter to you at all. But it should, because this will dictate the future of how the sport is covered. And it'll dictate the future of how the PGA Tour is covered. And if you love the PGA Tour and if you love following professional golf, this will matter to you, because you may well in the future have two outlets giving you the majority of the inside coverage, whitewashing it in a way that, because they pay for it in terms of Golf Channel and NBC and CBS, they're going to appeal to the tour's message. If you want that, that's fine. If you have no problem with that, that's fine. But if you want something with a little bit more of an independent streak, with a little bit more flair, then I would very strongly consider caring about this argument and where you're going to get your news and information in the future. And if it doesn't come from other outlets than those three, what that might mean for how other tours are covered. And do not think for a single second that the folks of the LPGA and the European Tour are not seeing what's going on here and thinking, how can we make this work for us? Because they want coverage, and they deserve coverage, to be honest with you, as much as the PGA Tour does. It's an interesting time to be in the media. That'll do it for this week on the show. Next week on the program, we'll go over the Players' Championship. We'll figure out who we decide is the best player in the world this week, and whether it's Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, or somebody else that wins this tournament. We'll go over that as well as any other news of the week. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Follow me on Twitter @RyanBallenge. Check me out on Yahoo Sports, sports.yahoo.com. Until next time, I'm Ryan Ballenge saying thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.